From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Dan Ravie, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. In the Middle East, Lebanon, a country that is no stranger to tragedy, suffered a severe blow this past Tuesday evening in the capital, Beirut. A massive explosion killed, it's believed, hundreds of people and wounded thousands, perhaps due to mismanagement and neglect. And the continuing coronavirus crisis worldwide, the number of confirmed cases going into the weekend, nearly 18 million. The number who've died, more than 700,000, including here in the United States, about 160,000. The disease called COVID-19 keeps spreading, but we'll talk about some rays of hope, perhaps, such as work on vaccines. And of course, we'll consider how the presidential campaign here in the United States is proceeding. Less than 3 months until American voters decide on November 3rd whether Donald Trump continues as president or will he be replaced by Joe Biden. Let's turn first to the disaster in Beirut. Rapidly after Tuesday's huge explosion, more than 100 bodies were found. Then hundreds of Lebanese were listed as missing. Thousands had to be treated in hospitals already burdened by coronavirus. Many billions of dollars of damage sustained, while the economy of that country is very weak. Josh Glancy, that's a definite front page subject for your British newspaper, The Sunday Times. And for readers and people who browse the internet everywhere, would you agree Beirut and Lebanon have often symbolized suffering, yes?
Yeah, Dan, the pictures we saw of Beirut, although uniquely shocking in terms of the size of the explosion, were sort of painfully familiar in terms of how many times we've seen that city in a state of desolation, in a state of trauma. And so many journalists have friends in Beirut. It's a sort of, it's a city of journalists in many ways. And talking to them, there was a sort of painful familiarity with people having to pick their lives back together again. A lot of people in the city have seen things like this before, but the size of the explosion and the scale of the damage is nonetheless quite astonishing. I mean, 250,000 people homeless and counting. So it really is quite shocking.
So there was a fire at the port and the investigation continues, but government officials in Lebanon say apparently the main cause was that 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate, it's used as fertilizer but also as an explosive, was stored in a building at the port of Beirut, not well contained or secured. Reports said it came from a Russian ship that was seized due to a legal dispute 6 years ago. No one did anything about it. There it was until it exploded this past Tuesday. But Linda Feldman, well, you were busy covering President Trump at the White House, and he said that he believed that he knew the cause, and he said it was an attack. He said maybe a bomb. Did America's president offer any evidence?
He did not. So this is what he had said on Tuesday, that he thought it was an attack and that he had spoken to his great generals about it. And then there was some pushback on Wednesday when I was at his briefing. He was asked again, did he believe it was an attack or was it an accident? And he said, it could be either. You have some people who think it was an attack and some people think it wasn't. Notably, earlier in the day, his defense secretary, Mark Esper, had said he believes it was an accident. So this is yet another example of a top cabinet secretary explicitly crossing the president's official line on an event. This is the president, I think, speaking without knowledge. He doesn't like to look unknowledgeable, so he just speaks without really knowing.
Josh, as a foreign correspondent, when you write about that, that the president acted as though he had an explanation, he thought it was an attack in Beirut. How do you frame it, that maybe Mr. Trump had some intelligence information?
Well, truth is, Dan, I actually sometimes try and filter those kind of things out from our audience, because it can often just be confusing misinformation. If obviously one has to take the president's utterances seriously because of the office he holds, you know, they're usually rooted in something he's heard or some interpretation of some information that he's been given. But sometimes I don't think it's actually that helpful to report it too aggressively until more of it is revealed. If there is, you know, intelligence sources start to say, well, actually, maybe we are seeing some information on that, then maybe. But sometimes it's just not helpful, I think, to give people too much of that sort of, certainly to blare it over the headlines, because it can be a distraction from, frankly, you know, the real story here is what we're hearing in the port in Beirut and what we're seeing on the streets of Lebanon today.
And Linda, just to be clear, the president did also offer assistance to Lebanon. And he says there's a very good relationship with the government there, despite a lot of controversy over the Iran-dominated Hezbollah party being part of Lebanon's coalition. But still, it does seem the United States probably will be helping Lebanon to some extent.
Yes, the United States and Donald Trump always like to appear helpful in the case of a humanitarian tragedy. Already, we have the French president, Emmanuel Macron, visiting Lebanon for a few hours to offer help and solidarity. Paris has sent plane loads of specialists and supplies and rescue workers to the country where that was its colony at one point. Honestly, the magnitude of the destruction, the lives lost, just, I mean, looking at the images is just absolutely shocking for a country that has suffered so much over the decades.
And Josh, isn't there an issue for every country, maybe every government, to check how hazardous waste is stored or buried or disposed of? That can include nuclear materials, old bombs, industrial explosives. I have to think that every responsible official in every country is checking whether Beirut could happen where they are.
You would certainly hope so, Dan. I mean, when you look at some of the details that are emerging of what happened, the level of neglect is quite shocking. I mean, it was there for 6 years, this huge package of explosives, and there were repeated requests from customs officials in the port to the Lebanese judiciary, you know, can we do something about this? Can we get rid of it? Those requests apparently went ignored for 6 years, which is just remarkable. So you would hope, and actually, in a way, what this shows us is that, you know, there are diligent officials in our ports all over the world that are actually, you know, taking care of this kind of thing every day. We should be very grateful for it. But I think you're absolutely right. People will be double checking their warehouses today.
They certainly should. Now let's change the subject to the health hazard that we're all facing in just about every nation on earth, and that is coronavirus, COVID-19. Just about every nation has to decide whether to reopen its economy, send the kids back to school, allow restaurants and other businesses to reopen. Linda, here in Washington, who's taking sides on this? Because, of course, everything is political. Is it Donald Trump and his Republicans on one side of the argument versus the Democrats? Who is emphasizing the need to reopen?
Well, you're seeing it isn't completely Democrats versus Republicans. You do sometimes have Republicans going against the president and urging caution on the reopening of schools, but it does largely fall across party lines. You have, you know, the president is very eager to reopen the schools, a position that I completely understand. Sending children back to school is the key to reopening the economy. And without children in some kind of school at least a couple of days a week, it makes it very, very, very difficult for parents who do have jobs to work, for essential workers who tend to be blue collar, working in grocery stores, and healthcare workers who have children. If they're lucky, they have, say, a grandparent who can watch them or friends, but it just makes life very dicey. So the reopening of schools isn't just about the appearance of returning life to normal. It's about the actual survival of the economy and getting things going. And where we are now is almost all the major cities have opted not to have in-person school starting this fall. And in some cities, well, in a few places, school has already started. In some cities, it's a matter of a couple of weeks. New York City is supposed to open in a month. As of now, they're going to have in-person school, but they don't have enough nurses to staff all the school buildings. They don't have ventilation systems that have been upgraded to keep the air as safe as is possible under the circumstances. So we face the possibility of teacher strikes and, again, millions and millions of children stuck at home, allegedly learning online, but in a lot of cases not.
As we all know, the United States has the largest economy on earth and has great capabilities. And of course, hopes have been raised again by Dr. Anthony Fauci and other government scientists that all the drug companies and researchers and universities that are working on a possible vaccine to prevent people from contracting COVID-19 will succeed. Dr. Fauci was saying that he thinks there may well be tens of millions of doses of a vaccine ready by early next year, maybe half a year from now. Now, Josh, when you write about it for your British newspaper, for instance, I mean, has that become a big question? Like, how did the most capable and perhaps advanced country on earth suffer such a very harmful and severe death rate from COVID? I mean, are you framing it as a failure? Because, of course, President Trump says the U.S. is doing very well.
Well, you know, there is a tendency in even among America's allies for people to shake their heads in America and think, gosh, what a basket case. I do always like to remind people that actually, if you look at the death rate per capita, America is still well behind Britain and France and Spain and Italy and much of Western Europe. Although the overall numbers are terrible and rising, and the duration of the pandemic here is obviously catastrophic economically, the overall numbers are broadly in line with comparable countries in Europe. So nonetheless, the failure of America to kind of unify behind a strategy and the diversity in approaches, which sometimes is a strength, but actually, you know, in this case, I think is proving something of a weakness, is something that, you know, I do present to our readers and that I do think people are somewhat baffled, and particularly by some of the messaging that comes out of the Oval Office on this, which doesn't necessarily seem to cleave to the science at all times.
Public opinion polls here in the U.S. suggest that most people think that something is going wrong, that the way that government authorities at every level have handled COVID-19 has been far from perfect. And we just want to note that Australia's second largest city, Melbourne, and the state of Victoria are under a severe lockdown, including a curfew and travel restrictions, as Australians try to stop an apparent surge in coronavirus there. We'll have more on COVID-19 and America's presidential election campaign after this short break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Linda, maybe in part because of the American election coming on November 3rd, a widespread lockdown in this country, even a repeat of what most of America did in April and May, it seems out of the question. Would you agree?
I would agree. I mean, all along the United States, especially under the Trump administration, has been all about local control, allowing governors to make their own decisions about what makes sense for their states. And there is a logic to that. The more urban states have one set of considerations with regard to the virus, whereas more rural states, they're more spaced out, obviously. So widespread lockdown isn't in the cards. I think the larger question is how people respond to efforts by governments, whether it's their governor, their mayor, or the president himself, to request to behave in certain ways. We have been pounded for months about wearing masks, about social distancing, about washing our hands constantly. To a lot of people, a shocking number of Americans just do not follow those directives. Part of it is just American culture. Americans are very individualistic and don't like to be told what to do, don't like the government telling them how to behave in their personal behavior. And to me, the most alarming element of this is that when there is a vaccine, assuming that an effective vaccine does come online, a lot of Americans are not willing to take it. So you could have this idea that we could ever gain herd immunity through a combination of people having the disease and becoming immune, although we don't even know for sure if having the disease causes immunity and having a vaccine, if we will really knock this thing down. Last Friday in Congress, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top epidemiologist, said that the coronavirus is so contagious that it won't ever likely be completely gone. which was very sobering, but it's just a fact of life. I mean, we may be living with this for the rest of our lives.
It's been interesting to note what some Americans think is absolutely vital, and that includes sports. Baseball had to cancel quite a few games when players and coaches tested positive for COVID-19. NBA basketball, popular all around the world, well, every game is being played in one location, Orlando, Florida. NHL hockey confined to two locations in Canada with constant testing, hoping to block spread of the virus while still giving some entertainment to sports fans because there's no audience there. It's all for TV and radio. But university or college sports, it looks like most of that is being canceled for the coming semester. Josh, what's your impression? Americans, I guess, are struggling to have a little piece of something normal.
Yes, I mean, sports a funny thing in a way because it feels utterly futile and irrelevant on one level, and yet on another level, what could be more important right now than the distraction of athleticism and the passion of sports? I'm a huge sports fan and a big Manchester United football fan, and the moment that my soccer team was playing again, life just felt a little bit more normal and a little bit more worthwhile. And that sounds a little sad, but Americans love their sports, and even an empty baseball stadium or an empty basketball court is better than nothing.
Josh, as a foreign correspondent in this country, I can only guess that you were looking forward to it being a presidential election year. There'd be the big political party conventions. They were set for North Carolina and Wisconsin. They're practically canceled. The candidates, Donald Trump, and for the Democrats, former Vice President Joe Biden, announced that they will not be going to their party conventions. Just about everything will be done online. It's a really big change. And Linda, when it comes to the Republicans, Mr. Trump at first didn't want it all to be in Charlotte, North Carolina, a dispute with local officials, how to handle coronavirus. He was mad at the Democrats there. So he said he'd have a lot of the convention in Jacksonville, Florida. Mm-hmm. But there's been a COVID-19 surge there. So now delegates will go to North Carolina. The president will not. What is Donald Trump's plan for his speech that's supposed to end the convention on August 27th?
Right. So the president is going to stay in Washington. That's the latest plan. He's even thinking of delivering his acceptance speech from the White House lawn, which in fact raises legal issues because it's a political act taking place on White House property. The president, I mean, he was asked about that at the briefing. He said he's not subject to the Hatch Act, which is the law that prevents federal workers from engaging in politics from work. The more important aspect of this is that he is being deprived of his lifeblood, which is gigantic, cheering, adoring crowds. He desperately, desperately wants that. He had that disastrous rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma a few weeks ago. And of course, one of his friends, Herman Cain, passed away. He attended that rally, didn't wear a mask. We don't know that he got the virus at that rally, but it just was a reminder that having big packed events, even though this one wasn't full, there were still 6,000 people there, just really isn't a good idea in times like this. And we have to do everything, a lot of things online, and the stuff that we do in person, you got to wear a mask, you got to keep your distance. And this is just the antithesis of what Donald Trump is all about.
Obviously, he'll make it as big as he can. Again, the Republican convention, where he formally becomes nominated as the candidate this year for his party, is to end on August 27th. The week before that, the Democrats scheduled their convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So we now know Joe Biden won't go to that, but still they're going to try to build some momentum. But maybe Biden's going to try to get a lot of energy from his announcement of a running mate, his candidate for vice president. As of the time that we're recording this program, we don't know who the running mate will be. But Josh, what do we know?
Well, we know who the leading candidates are, and it's really coming down to two or three, we think. Senator Kamala Harris of California, Susan Rice, former national security advisor to Barack Obama. Elizabeth Warren is still in the mix, senator from Massachusetts, and Karen Bass, a congresswoman from California too. They're the candidates that we know are being looked at and vetted. This is going on a little longer than people thought, but not abnormally so. Biden, it's not exactly clear what he wants. There's some sense that he's not sure if he wants someone who is a bigger name or if he wants someone who's sort of less well-known so that he can kind of lead the ticket more obviously. So There's a lot of wrangling behind the scenes. As you can imagine, people are jockeying for what is, in any administration, you know, potentially a very influential position. But in this one, particularly, because Biden is not a young man. And so whoever has this job will be in prime position to run for president in 2024 and will probably assume a more active role, perhaps, than in other administrations. So, yeah, all eyes on the VP pick.
What a good point. It could be seen as important. Donald Trump is 74 years old. The Democrat, Joe Biden, he will turn 78 just after Election Day. And so, Linda, I don't know what the tasteful way is to say this, but many Americans think that, you know, Biden may not make it through a four-year term. So it becomes more important who's the vice president. And again, Biden did promise publicly it will be a woman.
That's right. And he's under pressure to pick a woman of color. And that it doesn't necessarily mean a black woman. It could be Tammy Duckworth, who is Asian American, senator from Illinois. Yeah, this is a really, really important selection. Typically for a presidential nominee, it's the most important decision they make in the run-up to the election. There's some thinking that he had initially promised to name the running mate by August 1st, and he keeps pushing it off, which is creating this image either that he's indecisive or that he doesn't like any of them well enough to have an obvious pick. The hope is among the Democrats that when he does name his running mate, that it will immediately create a new dynamic, that it will excite a larger base of voters than who he has now. There was polling out that showed that in particular, young black voters are absolutely not excited about Joe Biden. Less than half plan to vote for him. You know, a few will vote for Donald Trump, and a lot of them just plain won't vote at all. Voting has gotten very complicated this year for obvious reasons. And if we do have problems with the mail and with the issuance of ballots through the mail, either receiving them and then getting them back to the election officials in time, we could have, frankly, kind of a chaotic election come November 3rd.
Well, President Trump keeps saying that if many millions of ballots are mailed in, and that is the plan in many states in order to prevent spread of the coronavirus, more ballots will be mailed in. The president says clearly that will cause some fraud. He said some of the ballot papers could be forgeries, even foreign governments could do that. And the president says that'll be very hard for the U.S. Postal Service to deliver so many ballots in good time. Josh, what do you make of all that?
The president's concerns about fraud are somewhat overwrought. I mean, there is not a lot of evidence of serious fraud in mail-in voting. But there is a possibility of chaos, as Linda points out. There is a real issue. I mean, you've seen there's a primary going on in New York at the moment where they've been counting the results for weeks now because of mail-in voting partly. And there's a number of quite troubling scenarios where you have mail-in voting and it's affecting a key race. You know, if the presidential race comes down to, say, Wisconsin or Arizona, and mail-in voting, and it's close, and mail-in voting is delaying the process, things could get pretty turbulent. The president won't hesitate to voice his opinions on the matter. And if Democrats feel like the election is somehow being mismanaged, they'll get pretty riled up too. So there's a lot of concern about how the election might sort of play out logistically, which, you know, could, in the worst case scenarios, lead to some sort of democratic crisis, constitutional crisis in America. But hopefully it'll just be a bit rocky and we'll get through it. I think what's really crucial is that if there's a clear winner, then we're fine. If it's really close and we see something like year 2000, Bush versus Gore in Florida, then I think we're in for a rocky ride.
Well, I've heard from Democrats who say, oh, not only does Biden have to win in November, he has to win by a landslide. Linda, is there something to that? Has President Trump set up a situation where many Americans might not consider the result credible?
He has. He was asked, would he accept the election result if it doesn't go his way? And he said, we'll see. But this is his typical rhetoric. I'm not sure that he wouldn't accept the election result if he loses. All people who run elections say they just pray for it not to be close. There's always mistakes. There's always a little bit of fraud and cheating that goes on. You just don't want a close election. And Donald Trump is always trying to tinker with the rules. You know, he wants the first debate is supposed to be on September 29th. He wants it to happen sooner because some mail-in ballots are going out sooner than September 29th. And people are going to start voting in some states quite soon. The good news about American elections, actually, is that they're locally run. They're state run and even differ in the mechanics, district by district. So that makes it complicated, but it also prevents any kind of centralized effort to distort or cheat or otherwise skew the results.
Yeah, indeed, some experts have said sabotage an American election. There's not just one counting house. That doesn't seem easy or possible, but we'll see. That's all the time we have for this edition of Issues in the News. Thanks to Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the British newspaper The Sunday Times. This program is produced in Washington by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Levine.